issues facing you and your family in our one holy Catholic and Apostolic Church.
Catholic Connection, weekday mornings at 8 a.m. on 990 WDEO.
This is full-time Catholic radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Welcome back to Church and Culture. My guest for this next segment is Professor Christopher Cazor. I'm going to call him Chris for short, if you don't mind. He is originally from Seattle. He survived that and attended Boston College and then the University of Notre Dame, where he took a master's in medieval studies and a PhD in philosophy, studying under the renowned Ralph McInerney. He then did postdoctoral work in Cologne, went back as a Fulbright scholar, and hasn't wasted any time. He's published 8 books, and he hasn't wasted any time in the marriage side either. He lives in Los Angeles. He teaches at Loyola Marymount. He and his wife Jennifer have 7 children. So you need one more child to match the 8 books. You'll have 8 of each. I don't know if you've ever noticed that or not. Welcome, Dr. Chris Cazor.
Thank you, Theo.
And the specific reason for bringing you on the show today is your latest book, which you actually co-authored with your wife, Jennifer, from Ignatius Press, entitled The 7 Big Myths About Marriage, with the subtitle What Science, Faith, and Philosophy Teach Us About Love and Happiness. Now, I have to ask you, having read Jennifer, your wife's, part of her introduction here, did you really have the electricity turned off in your home?
No. My wife likes to slightly exaggerate a few things to make it a little more humorous. She's a little bit like the writer Irma Bombeck, but she kind of is a cross between that and David Sedaris. So with both those writers...
Is she that funny?
I think so. I think she's very...
Well, she is. I know she is because I read her. She's a very good writer and very funny, very clever. And y'all compliment each other very, very well.
Oh, thank you.
And you, how long have you been a professor at Loyola Marymount in Los Angeles?
I've been there since 1998, so over 15 years.
You're a real veteran then. And you have obviously thought long and hard about the kind of obstacles that people have when they're thinking about marriage, and you have put together this book under headings such as the first big myth, love is simple, and another one, the 6th big myth, children are irrelevant to marriage. What is it that prompted you and Jennifer to write this book?
Well, I was invited to teach a course, actually before I got to Loyola Marymount, my first job, the chair of the department came to me and said, would you teach this course on happiness, love, and marriage? The person who taught the course, has left the university and the students loved the course, so would you mind teaching it? And I thought, sure, I'll be happy to do that. When you're a young professor, you do whatever the chair of the department tells you to do. So I said, sure, I'll be happy to do that. And I taught the course, and I actually really did enjoy it. The students seemed to enjoy it, too. So I continued teaching it, and I've taught this course on happiness, love, and marriage for the last 15 years. And so over the course of the years, the course has changed quite a bit as I understood better the questions the students had and the place they were coming from. And so this book is really an effort to bring the very best of my course to a wider audience. You know,
And probably the biggest of the questions that keep repeating themselves from your students.
Exactly. You know, I can only teach 60 students a semester in my 2 sections of the class, but I really hope to be able to teach a much wider audience. And so I've been wanting to write this book for probably about 5 years or so, and I finally got a sabbatical. I got a chance to get a little time off, and so I did a bunch of writing during that time. And then, thank goodness, my wife also included a lot of her writings and stories in the book, too, which I think really adds a lot. So I'm very excited about the book.
In fact, you know, I go to co-written books, especially by husbands and wives, with a bit of skepticism. but yours works beautifully. Her voice and your voice are different, but they blend, and she's funny, and you're not overly serious, but you're straightforward. And it's a good book for anybody to get something from, and they can. They're certainly getting very, very sound theology and philosophy. I really marvel at the way you wove Thomistic philosophy and church teaching into what is a very readable book. Was that a struggle for you to do that?
Oh, well, thanks for those kind words. I don't think it was really a struggle. You mentioned I worked with Ralph McInerney, and I try to take a page out of Ralph's book to make the thinking of Aquinas accessible and and easy for people to understand. I mean, Thomas is wonderful, but I think Thomas is a sort of acquired taste. It's a little bit like, drinking beer or whiskey or something. I think most people, the first time they have a whiskey, they think, wow, this is really not very good. But if you keep going, it grows on you, and you begin to have a taste for it. But I think that most people, the whiskey is a little bit strong for them, so this is a little bit more along the lines of beer, where it's more accessible. And
well, it's exactly the way Aquinas applied his own first principles in the Summa, as you well know. I mean, he got all the way down to the pastoral level. And a lot of people that don't give the Summa a chance, they can't get past the metaphysics of the opening chapter. They never get to the books on love and faith, the virtue,
right.
The virtue sections, where it's tremendously pastoral in nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right. So in this book, what I've tried to do is bring in philosophy and theology, but also to talk about the psychology and the sociology of marriage. There's lots of evidence out there, especially, say, in terms of cohabitation and many other issues, where the church's teaching really has been vindicated by the findings of contemporary science. And so in the book, what I'm trying to do is show people that really faith and reason are working together here, and what the church proposes to us in terms of how we should live is really reflected in the best evidence that we have from contemporary science.
I'm talking with Professor Chris Cazor from Los Angeles. He's been on the faculty for 15 years at Loyola Marymount there. Very lovely school, by the way. Sits on a hill overlooking a beautiful view. And I want to start with your fourth big myth out of your seven, cohabitation. Now, I'll just say that I'm 64. And when I grew up as a teenager and a young adult, if you just didn't do that. I mean, you didn't even ponder it. And if you did, you were noticeably shamed by your, not just your parents, but by your peers. What has happened to make cohabitation so acceptable?
Well, it has. Cohabitation certainly has increased over the last, 30 years or so. And now it's really seen by many people as a kind of step towards marriage. It's almost like a pre-engagement or something.
It's legitimized as that, as a step toward marriage.
I think it is. There's lots of people who think of it that way. Unfortunately, the reality, though, is that the empirical data shows that 4 out of 5 cohabiting couples end up not getting married.
And by the way, let's repeat that. Let's repeat that statistic so everybody really hears it. Go ahead.
Sure. So 80% of the time, 4 out of 5 couples that live together prior to marriage end up not getting married. Only 1 out of 5 couples that cohabits does end up getting married.
And are there any statistics on the success of that 5%, 20% who actually get married? Are there any statistics on their staying married?
There are, yes. In the book, I talk about the fact that basically what they found is that living together prior to marriage increases the likelihood of divorce after marriage, and that even among the couples that do not divorce after cohabiting, they report lower levels of marital satisfaction and happiness. So many people, again, think that cohabitation is a great way to make a relationship divorce-proof and to lower the likelihood of divorce, but the evidence actually points in the opposite direction, that cohabitation actually increases the likelihood of divorce.
I'm talking with Chris Cazor about his fourth big myth of marriage, cohabitation, being a good thing. I wonder, on this subject, how often you have come across pretty profound anecdotal evidence of the way cohabitation has backfired, especially for women. Because I have heard some very, personally, some horror stories about years and years of invested in the life of a man, and then suddenly just to be, dropped. And when the expectations were entirely different.
Yes, I think that's definitely true. What I argue is that cohabitation actually works systematically to the detriment of women. So they did a study worldwide about what most men look for in a marriage partner. And what they found basically is that worldwide men valued youth and beauty in their marriage partner more than women did. And then they found also worldwide that women valued good financial prospects and prestige and advancing in career more than most men did when they were looking for a marriage partner. So think about a typical case of cohabitation. You have a man and a woman who are both 25 who move in together. And let's say they live together for a while, and like most cohabiting couples, they end up not getting married. So now they're both 32. So what's happened over the course of that time is that the man has gained typically more of what most women are looking for. The man is further along in his
career. And the woman has lost it.
Exactly, and the woman is typically has lost more of what.
That's very interesting. I'm talking with Professor Chris Cazor from Loyola Marymount about the seven myths about marriage that he and his wife Jennifer have recently published. Beautiful book from Ignatius Press in San Francisco. And he obviously is doing more here than philosophizing. He has gone into the empirical research done by sociologists and psychologists on the outcomes of cohabitation on both well-being, which we call happiness, but also on the likelihood of divorce. Let's step back then to your third big myth, because this is the one that sort of took me aback. It wasn't immediately obvious to me what you were getting at. So it says, love alone makes a marriage. What is wrong with that?
Well, basically, many people do think that love alone is all you need for a marriage. And if that were true, then what you'd have to say is things that are rather counterintuitive. So in many polygamous marriages, right, one man and, four or five, six wives, they will say that they all love each other. And yet almost no one in our culture publicly defends the idea that we should have a polygamous marriage and that all you need is love. So that case alone seems to show that, well, to be a real marriage, more than just love is needed. And in fact, in the marriage vow, the couple promises to love each other. But to make the marriage vow legitimate, more than just words needs to be said. So I could fly off to Las Vegas today and maybe find a showgirl and get married and say words to her. And
but you're not talking about love in the deeper sense there.
Well, love is a term that's ambiguous. I mean, that is mm-hmm. to say, love has a variety of meanings. And in the first chapter, I talk about the various meanings love can have. So there's, erotic love, there's friendship love, there's parental love. And these kinds of love are similar in some ways, but they're also importantly different in other ways.
Do they combine for marital happiness? I mean, how do the loves combine or disconnect or arrange themselves around and through a happy marriage?
Well, I'd say in a happy marriage, you have a combination of love. So you have erotic love, kind of a romantic sort of love in a happy marriage. And I think you also have the kind of love called friendship, right? Hopefully
right.
Friendship of virtue in Aristotle's sense in a happy marriage. But what's really promised in marriage is not that we're going to always have romantic love for each other. And the reason that can't be promised in marriage is that romantic love has to do with our emotions and feelings, and we really don't have control over those things. We can only promise about things over which we have control. So it makes no sense for me to promise you, Deal, that tomorrow in Washington, D.C., it's going to be 75 degrees and there'll be no snow on the ground. I can't make that happen. I can only promise about things that I at least possibly have control over. So
well, what takes the place What takes the place of romantic love since it's fragile?
Well, hopefully when the couple gets married, they do have romantic love. And hopefully when the couple gets married, they also are friends. But what's promised in the marriage vow, it seems to me, is not friendship and it's not romantic love. What's promised is that the person promises to be united with the person as their spouse in good times and in bad, in sickness and in health, till death do us part. So the kind of love that's promised is a kind of unitive love, that the person promises to have goodwill for the person as their spouse, promises to choose to appreciate the person as their spouse, and probably most importantly, chooses to be united with the person as their spouse.
And so now, that's the kind that of does, that's I mean, promised. That does suggest love in the sense of the virtue of love. In
right. So the love that love has these different senses, but the love that's a matter of choice and a matter of decision is the kind of love that's promised in a marriage. It's not just again about emotions or even about friendship. It's about.
Do we have a word for that? I mean, agape is normally associated with divine love, eros with desire, erotic love, philia with friendship, storge with love, maternal love. But do we have a word for the I'd almost just call it mature grown-up love that you just described. Do we have a special word for that?
I don't think there really is a kind of special word for that. I'm persuaded by the arguments of Alexander Priss, who writes in his book One Body, that agape, the Greek term agape, actually just means what we in contemporary English mean by love. That is to say, agape includes all these different kinds of love, erotic love, friendship, etc., underneath it as different forms of agape. So I think that's actually right. So the kind of love that I'm talking about is, I would call it marital love. In other words, what's mm-hmm. distinctive about marital love is, again, that you've made a vow, you've made a promise to love this person in a particular way as your spouse and to be united with the person in a particular way. Right, not as your tennis partner or as your law partner, but as your marital partner, as your spouse. So that's what I think is special and unique and specific about marital love, that it reflects the marital vow, the vows of marriage that take place during the wedding ceremony.
Talking about Christopher Cazor and Jennifer Cazor's book, The Seven Big Myths About Marriage, recently published by Ignatius, I remember when marriage was first explained to me by a Presbyterian pastor, he said exactly what you say is not true in your second big myth. He said marriage is a 50-50 contract. So you take issue with that.
I do. I think that, first of all, marriage is not, properly speaking, a contract, but is a covenant. And the difference between this contract and covenant, I'd say, is this. That in a contract, you're exchanging goods and services, right? You have a contract with the person who paints your house, right? They'll paint your whole house for you, and you'll pay them, you know, $2,000. It's an exchange of goods and services. A covenant, by contrast, is about creating a family bond. It's about giving yourself to the person, that person giving himself or herself to you.
Regardless.
Exactly. And so it's not really about kind of a 50-50 deal. Really, it's, I'd say, a 100%, 100% deal. So when I got married, I promised my wife, I'm going to love you as my wife until death do us part, without condition. There was no, if you love me back, or if you do a good job as my wife, or as long as you're, you know, as beautiful as you are now. It was, I'm going to love you as long as we both shall live, period.
So your point is, neither party holds anything back.
Exactly. The marital covenant is about creating a family bond where the husband gives himself as a husband to his wife exclusively and permanently, and then the wife gives herself as wife exclusively and permanently 100%. And so it really is important, I think, to think of it as a covenant about unconditional love rather than as a contract, which only involves conditional love. I'll love you so long as you X, Y, or Z, whatever that is.
Which, of course, has deep resonance with certain parts of Scripture that are relevant to marriage and to the Holy Trinity, but we don't need to go there.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, I mean, it's beautiful, but it's a little bit off the beaten path, especially when you're obviously trying to speak to people here who probably don't agree with you in the first place, who probably would dispute what you're saying. If somebody, you know, Flannery O'Connor style, you know, a good man is hard to find. If I put a gun to your head and said, Dr. Kazor, what is the one thing about love that my generation just doesn't get? Tell me the one big thing. What would you say?
Wow, that's a hard question. You know, in the book, I try to call out, you know, the 7 big myths, and it would have been easy to write, you know, the 300 big myths or something, because there's so many things I think that are misunderstood. So to boil down the 7 to 1 would be even harder. But I think it would boil down to this, that I think everyone wants to be happy. And I think that this is deep within our reality as human beings. And that ultimately our happiness is to be found in love. And that if we choose not to love, we're choosing not simply not to love, we're also choosing really not to be as fully happy as we otherwise would be. So the introduction of the whole book really tries to map out how our happiness is to be found in love. It's a way of re-presenting, you know, the insights of Augustine about our hearts being restless until they rest in God, the insights of Aquinas about the fundamental norm being about love of God and love of neighbor. And obviously this comes right from the words of Jesus. And I think in a way that is the most important thing, that people try in our culture so hard to find happiness through mere bodily pleasure, or to find happiness through having more money or more power or more fame than other people. But the reality is we can have as much bodily pleasure as possible. We can have as much money, fame, and power as possible, and yet actually be very miserable. And
but so, you didn't answer my question. Doctor.
Okay, well, please.
I mean, I'm really desperate here. I've gone through, okay. I'm pretending, I've gone through serial relationships, been broken up with, I've broken up with them. We thought we were going to get married. It didn't work out. She was hurt. I was hurt. Obviously, there's some confusion here at the root of the way I'm living and loving. What's that confusion?
I guess I'd say that it is really about how to find happiness. I mean, if we seek happiness, it seems to me, through giving of ourselves to others, through serving others, through being grateful and thankful for all the things that other people do for us, through forgiving others. Now, that doesn't mean, if we do those things, it doesn't mean our life's going to be without difficulties. We'll have challenges and troubles. But it seems to me we're going to have a much more enriched life, a life where we really avoid harming other people and hurting them to a much greater degree than if we live a life simply focused on the kinds of happiness that, you know, a celebrity might be able to have. So,
and, of course, the other side of that is that people conceive of happiness as something that does belong to themselves, but then they don't see how it contrasts with actions and beliefs and convictions that actually hurt yourself. I mean, they think it's okay to hurt yourself, but they don't realize that in hurting yourself, you're destroying your happiness.
Right, right. Yeah, and I think that, as you know, for Augustine, for Aquinas, and I think also for Jesus, the foundation of ethics ultimately is really about love of God and love of neighbor. And you might say, well, who cares about that? I don't want to love God. I don't want to love my neighbor. But the reason I think everyone should care about that is that that's the path to finding happiness. And in the book, what I argue is, you know, this connection between happiness and love, it's not just a matter that theology talks about or philosophy. This is also empirical psychology. The positive psychologists talk a great deal about the absolute fundamental importance of relationships for happiness. So I think, you know, we're getting this confirmed in new ways today through empirical science.
Your first myth is the phrase love is simple. Now, we've touched on that a little bit when we went through our Greek vocabulary for love, but what kind of complexity in love are people missing?
Well, I'll tell you what I was missing, Deal, for a long time, I'm embarrassed to say. For a long time, I thought about love simply in terms of goodwill. And that's true. All kinds of love do involve goodwill.
Right? Wishing the good for the other.
Exactly. But what I didn't realize for many years is that love isn't just goodwill for the other. It also involves appreciating the other, seeing the good in the other person. In other words, if I have goodwill for you and, you know, you're hungry and I, you know, throw some money in your cup, but I absolutely think you're a piece of trash and I can't stand you, and, you know, you're just a walking worm. Well, you know, I can't say I really love you. I mean, you know, yeah, I did something good for you. I gave you some money. You needed that, but I don't love you. Real love, it seems to me, involves also seeing how this person images God, seeing how this person has gifts, this person has talents, this person maybe has lots of potential, seeing the good that is in the person. That's really a part of love. And then finally, a part of love I didn't really appreciate until recently is that love always involves seeking unity with someone. So the love of friendship, for instance, you have goodwill for your friend, you appreciate the good things about your friend, but you also want to be united with your friend, do activities together, go bowling, ride a bike, you know, go to the movies, do something. Romantic love involves seeking unity, right? They have goodwill, they appreciate the other, and they want to be united in a bodily sort of way. And the love between human beings and God also is like that. That is to say, we have goodwill for God when we try to carry out God's will in our life. We appreciate God, we worship Him, we see His great glory and beauty, and then we want to be united with Him. And so that's how we, as Catholics, believe we receive God's grace in the sacraments, and particularly in Holy Communion. So all kinds of love, I think, involve these three elements: goodwill, appreciation, and unity. But for a long time, I didn't really see that. I only saw the first part as important. But now I think it's true, actually, that the second and third part are also very important constitutive elements of love.
I'm talking with Professor Christopher Cazor from Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles about the book he co-authored with his wife Jennifer, The Seven Big Myths About Marriage, published by Ignatius. And we've gone through four of the seven, those being, now these are all myths: love is simple, marriage is a 50-50 contract, love alone makes a marriage, and cohabitation is just like marriage. When we come back after this break, we will do myth 5, 6, and 7, but I'm not telling you what they are, so you have to come back.
Old St. Patrick's Catholic Church on Whitmore Lake Road in Ann Arbor has been serving fresh, beer-battered Alaskan pollock on Fridays in Lent for over 30 years. We know how to make delicious fish and chips, and we'll tell you it's the best. But you don't have to take our word for it. Come on in and try it for yourself. We offer three choices of potatoes, or, if you like, mac and cheese. Graze at our salad bar. Don't forget your dinner roll, beverages, and even pie. Come on by and bring your family and friends to this beautiful place in the country, just north of Ann Arbor. While you're there, you can stop by our historic church and spend some time with the Lord, talking and listening to Him, or join us for the Stations of the Cross later in the evening. You can find out more information and directions at our website, www.stpatrickA2.org. That's www.stpatrick, the letter A, the number 2, dot org. And we'll save a plate for you.
This is a Marriage Minute with Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse.
The bishops of the Roman Catholic Church are preparing for their synod on pastoral challenges to the family. Here at the Ruth Institute, we wish to ask the synod fathers to remember the victims of the sexual revolution. We have a petition respectfully asking them to do just that. Think, for instance, of the suffering of the reluctantly divorced, those millions of unseen men and women whose marriages ended against their will. No-fault divorce means that the law takes sides with the spouse who wants the marriage the least. The husband, driven out of his home, living in a Spartan apartment by himself, seeing his children perhaps every other week. The wife, abandoned for a younger woman. We hope the Synod Fathers will remember the suffering of the victims of the sexual revolution. Please go to RuthInstitute.org to sign our petition to the Synod Fathers. That's RuthInstitute.org.
This has been a Marriage Minute. Go to RuthInstitute.org. Remember the victims of the sexual revolution. That's RUTHInstitute.org.
Welcome back. I'm talking with Professor Christopher Cazor about his book he wrote with his wife, The Seven Big Myths About Marriage. And, of course, I guess the fifth big myth is the one that will get the most attention and probably cause the most controversy for those who read it closely. Premarital sex is no big deal, you say.
That's right. Many of my students have never heard any sort of reason given why the church teaches that we should reserve sex for marriage. And they really just think it's kind of just this weird, odd rule, like, I don't know, don't eat fish on Friday or something. It just kind of, you know, just a disciplinary rule or something. So what I try to argue is that if we think about our happiness, it's based on love, as I mentioned. And love involves having goodwill for people. So if you love people, you have goodwill for them. And part of having goodwill for people is not risking or endangering their well-being. So why is drinking and driving wrong? Well, it's not wrong because every single time someone drives drunk, they always kill someone. No, many people drive drunk, and in a particular case, they may kill no one, and they drive get home safely. But still, driving drunk is wrong. Why? Well, because you're risking or endangering the well-being of other people on the road. And so what I argue in the fifth chapter is that one reason why sex outside of marriage is wrong is that sex outside of marriage risks or endangers the well-being of others. First of all, the two people involved in terms of sexually transmitted diseases and other emotional problems that come from promiscuous sex. But secondly, in terms of the child who may be conceived. So all sex outside of marriage risks pregnancy outside of marriage. And if there's a pregnancy outside of marriage, there's really only a few limited options available to the couple. The couple could have the child aborted. That obviously not just risks the child's well-being, but ends the child's life and harms the child in an irreparable way. The child, or they could choose to, the mom could raise the child alone, or the dad could raise the child alone, single parenthood. But as you probably know, the children of single parents are endangered in a variety of ways. They're more likely to drop out of school, more likely to get arrested, more likely to be involved in drugs and alcohol. The couple could live together and raise the child in a cohabiting situation. But there's been lots of research that also risks or endangers the well-being of the child who is raised in that situation. Finally, the last two options are they could place the child for adoption or they could get married.
You talk about the concrete outcomes that are dangerous, hurtful, destructive. But people who jump into premarital sex, they're not thinking about outcomes. They're thinking about the moment.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's right. And I think the same thing could be true of drunk driving. I mean, you know, do people that drive drunk sit down after the, you know, eighth beer and say, wow, geez, maybe I shouldn't do this. I'm risking other people's well-being. Well, I'm guessing if they're really drunk, they probably don't think about much of anything. They just get in the car and go. But when people are sober, hopefully you can reason with them and say, look, this is a really serious thing. You shouldn't drive drunk. Here's why. And hopefully when people are sitting in the classroom and they're not in the heat of the moment, you can reason with them and say, look, this is really serious and this is a bad idea. You know, don't do this. Now, are people going to have sex outside of marriage after they take my course? I don't know. Maybe some of them will. But I've actually talked to students who said that they decided not to have sex outside of marriage on the basis of what we talked about in the course. And in a similar way, people still drive drunk, even though there's public campaigns and laws and advertising, you know, saying we shouldn't do that. So human beings are weak, and they do things in the heat of the moment that, you know, really aren't serving anyone's best interest.
No.
I think that's part of the human condition, but I don't think it falls from that. We shouldn't talk about it.
I have to ask you, Dr. Kazor, this argument you make in your book against premarital sex, have you actually experienced a situation where you were arguing this with somebody, perhaps someone younger than you are, and you actually saw a mind change?
Well, I think for many students, again, they've never heard any argument whatsoever.
Oh, that's true.
So,
in fact, they've heard only sort of blank acceptance, I suppose.
Exactly. Yeah. So this is for many of these students really kind of shocking. I mean, they can hardly, you know, believe it. And so I have had many students report to me that as a result of thinking about these issues, they really do think about it in a different way. And I think that, I've had students write to me after the course is done and say things like, well, when I took your course, I thought, oh, this is crazy. This can't be true. And now that I'm 25, 30, whatever, I actually think that you were right and that what you said was really on target. So, you know, the thing is, who knows how people will, react. I imagine it'll be a little bit like spreading the gospel. You know, some seed falls on rocky ground and some falls on ground with a lot of weeds and some falls on good ground. And my job isn't to try to figure out, where someone's soul is. My job is just to try to say what I think is true as best I can and hope for the best.
How old are you, Dr. Kazor?
I'm 44.
Okay. Roughly 20 years older than you are. Have you observed that in your lifetime enough damage has been done that is actually experienced by people, observed by people, written about in novels, filmed in movie after movie, sung about in music? In other words, all this wisdom that you are expressing through your book has actually been embodied both in reality and in art, warning people against the very things you're warning against them. Do you think there is a cultural turn in the direction that you're writing about?
That's a good question. I'm not really sure. I think that people are aware, probably to a greater extent than ever before, that something's kind of wrong. Right, something seems to be, even people that really aren't Catholic and don't accept the church teachings, I think they do sense there's something a little messed up about kind of the way things are going between the sexes. So one indication of this is in the hookup culture, they've done some research about what people's experiences are like. And basically what people report is this. They say, well, I was really looking for pleasure, for empowerment, and for meaning in hooking up with someone. And so then they asked, okay, great. Well, did you find pleasure, empowerment, and meaning in hooking up? And what they found basically is that almost everyone says, no, I didn't. I didn't. It wasn't that pleasurable. It wasn't that meaningful, and I really didn't feel that empowered by it. So there's an interesting disconnect, I think, between kind of what people are doing on the one hand and kind of what the culture or what they're really experiencing on the other hand. So I think that's important to kind of bring that up and bring that.
Yeah, well, you live right outside Hollywood, and so you must be very aware of film culture. And one thing I've observed in the last, I'd say, 7 or 8 years is that you get fewer and fewer films sort of glorifying what you call the hookup culture, and more films about the destruction that results from that culture. So I'm wondering if younger minds, screenwriters, actors, directors, you know, people who have kind of lived through this are beginning to move in your direction. They may not use your language. They may not accept your arguments, you know, philosophically or from a Catholic point of view. But they know something's wrong, and they know it has to change, but they're not quite sure what's wrong or why and what to do about it.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think that's right. There is a bit of a crisis, I think, and people, I think, on all sides of the spectrum are somewhat aware of this. And so I think in a way that's a good thing. There's the sort of easy dogmatism of, you know, everyone will do whatever they want, everything will be great. I think that is now being seen as somewhat suspect. So my book is really an effort to try to give people some language, some evidence, some reasons for thinking that what the church proposes is really very healthy, very salutary, and very wise, really, ultimately. So what I'm trying to do really is just kind of bring together a lot of different voices and a lot of different information that is all available out there, but, you know, it hasn't yet been put together in this sort of format.
Well, let's talk about kids. You have seven kids in 8 books. That's right. And so you have your sixth big myth is children are irrelevant to marriage. Now, I must say that I don't think I've actually heard somebody say it that bluntly, but I have heard people say, yes, we're going to get married, but we're not going to have kids, which is sort of the same thing. How are you hearing this communicated, this attitude toward children?
Well, I think there's a huge fear among many people about having children. Many people see only the expense and only the challenge and the headaches that come with children. And so, you know, they really fear, shy away from having children. And so
there's no greater joy in life than having and raising children, is there?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think my children have blessed me in immense ways, you know, really on an ongoing basis.
A lot of suffering, too. But
I think that's right. There's suffering, but there's also deep happiness. And in a way, you know, again, we go back to the importance of love for happiness. You know, if you love someone, that is to make yourself vulnerable. You know, if you really love someone, you care about them. Well, if they get hurt, that's going to hurt you, too. So, you know, I think with the happiness comes necessarily a certain vulnerability, and all parents, I think, are very vulnerable in their own children. So you might have a PhD, you might be, you know, a professor, but when your child has a learning disability, like mine does, this makes it very challenging, very hard. I mean, you feel very sad, and there's nothing you can do about it. So I think, you know, along with the love comes a vulnerability, but nevertheless, I mean, obviously, on the whole, I think almost no parents regret having children and say, oh, my gosh, I wish I had no children and just been alone in my old age.
You know, and I wrote a book on happiness a while back, and as I thought through it, I came to the same conclusion you have, that a state of happiness requires vulnerability. Now, I put it at the time in philosophical terms. I called it a passion, a state of being acted upon. And when you are in a state of being acted upon, such as a child's love towards you or action, behavior, attitude towards you, you are vulnerable. But that vulnerability is part of your happiness. You have to let it happen.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, you could try, which I don't think you'd be successful, but you could try to be completely isolated from all human contact. But again, I think that's a recipe for deep loneliness and deep, deep unhappiness. I mean, you know, except for those extremely rare people who have a very special vocation, you know, to be in communion only with God and the angels. You know, outside of that, I think to be isolated from human contact is really to live a life that's going to be very, very unhappy.
Are children a natural outcome of this unified love, unitive love that you talked about earlier?
Exactly, yeah. So if romantic love and marital love is about achieving a unity, and in marriage the couple achieves a comprehensive union, the kind of deepest union that's possible between two people, well, that leads naturally to a bodily union of sexual intercourse, and then that leads naturally to you know, the fruit of that sexual intercourse. So children realize the goal of erotic love, to be united as thoroughly and deeply as you can be. Obviously, the unity exists on a physical level, because each child is comes from part of the father and part of the mother. But the unity almost always also is, you might say, a spiritual unity, where the couple is united in caring for the child. The couple is united in being happy when things go good for the child, and then sad when things go badly for the child. So there's a deep unity that's created through having children together, and that's why they found that couples that have children are much less likely to divorce. In fact, if you have four or more children, there's only a 3% likelihood of divorce for couples that have four or more children. So,
is that right? 3%?
Yeah.
So the move from 3 to 4 probably is a pretty big statistical jump.
I can open the book and tell you the exact page I talk about, the citation basically is that there's an inverse relationship between having children and divorcing, such that basically the more children you have, the more likely it is that you will stay married and not get divorced. So if you want to hold on a second, I'll try to look.
No. I think it's really a fascinating statistic, and really does, I think, make one of your strongest arguments about why children should not be excluded from marriage mentally or emotionally if you care about staying married. It's a natural outcome, and it's like the concrete that holds man and woman together. It seems to just make it stronger.
That's right. Yeah, Aristotle pointed that out, you know, centuries ago. He said that a childless couple is more likely to split up. And the quotation that I was looking for is right here. It says, it's page 171, according to a United Nations study of millions of people in 45 societies, 39% of divorces occur when there are no children, 26% when there's only a single child, 19% when there are two, and less than 3% when there are four or more children. So you can see that divorce, likelihood of divorce going down, down, down as the number of children goes up.
The last myth of your seven big myths about marriage that you and your wife wrote about in this book is that all reproductive choices are equal. Now, I would say that excluding children is a reproductive choice, so you've already covered that. Which reproductive choices are you talking about there?
I am talking about excluding children. We did talk about that. But I'm also talking about creating children, manufacturing children, using in vitro fertilization. So many couples today struggle with infertility. There are a variety of reasons for that. And some are tempted to use in vitro fertilization in order to have a child together. And that motive or intention to have a child together is beautiful and noble and good, but the difficulty is that some ways of achieving this noble end are morally problematic. So what I discuss is the evidence that in vitro fertilization increases the likelihood of a child having very severe mental disabilities. Basically, the likelihood of birth defects doubles with in vitro fertilization as compared to normal childbirth.
What kind of did you study on impact of that kind of childbearing on the longevity of the marriage itself?
No, I don't have any. There may be some evidence on that. I don't know of any evidence on that.
Of course, on the surface of it, it would seem that somebody who wants to go to that length to have a child is being motivated by a good aim, correct?
I mean, that's right.
They want what is good. How do they know that there are certain means that should be avoided in order to reach what is obviously a very good goal?
Well, part of, as we mentioned earlier, part of a person who is virtuous tries to avoid risking the well-being of others. And I think using in vitro fertilization is precisely that. It's risking the well-being of others in order to achieve some good end. And there are actually alternatives like NAPRO technology that are both less expensive than in vitro fertilization.
Well, which kind of technology?
It's called NAPRO technology.
What does that stand for?
Natural reproductive technology. It's a number of surgical and medical techniques that basically alleviate infertility, and the rates of success for this are actually about 80%, and about 80% of the time they can help a couple that was diagnosed as infertile to actually have children. And this is a much higher rate of success than in vitro fertilization, which has about a 30% likelihood.
So there really is no argument for in vitro anymore. I mean, you've eliminated it technologically, as it were. You've made it unnecessary.
I think that's right. Unnecessary, and it's more expensive and less likely to work. So it sort of has a moral problem, with it. It has an economic problem. It has an effectiveness problem. So NAPRO technology is superior in all three standards.
Do you have any friends or acquaintances that have used that technology to have children?
I don't, actually. I have there's only one acquaintance that I know of. Maybe there is others that I don't know about, but that is struggling with fertility issues, and I've let this person know about NAPRO technology, and I actually don't know whether or not they've used NAPRO technology. I just don't know.
I want to try to get maybe you can help me find somebody to get on the show to talk more about this. Maybe perhaps a surgeon or a doctor who actually uses this. I think this is fascinating and needs much more visibility, I think, than it's getting.
No, that's a very good point.
I mean, do you see it talked about very much?
No, not very much. The person you'd want to speak to is Thomas Hilgers. He's the
one. Oh, I know him.
Yeah, well, I always have him on the show then, because he has a whole book called The Medical and Surgical Practice of Naprotechnology. He's the really the world expert on that. So I talk about it in my book, but I'm not a medical doctor, so I'm just reporting kind of what he has reported.
Now, you're a doctor of love, happiness, and marriage.
Doctor of philosophy.
Well, no, you taught the course, love, happiness, and marriage, so you got to... You got to take it. You know, you got to take it when it's thrown at you. And now, going back to happiness, you you explain in the introduction to your book that your guidepost, as it were, as you worked your way through these myths about marriage, is happiness and our natural desire for it. There's a lot of confusion out there about what that is. I mean, you mentioned Father Spitzer's book, where he delineates four different types, you know, starting with the hedonist, going up to the faith altruist. But, you know, there aren't many people out there who are willing to really examine their own search for happiness. Do you agree?
I think that's right. Yeah, I think, unfortunately, what people do, I think, often is just kind of go with the flow, and they kind of say, well, you know, it seems like all these TV shows and movies and advertisements are saying happiness is just the life of a celebrity, and that must be it. So I'll try to imitate that as best I can. And, you know, unfortunately, we know from the life of real celebrities that life obviously does not bring real happiness. I mean, how many celebrities are so deliriously overjoyed with their hedonism and their egoism that at the end of it they end up killing themselves? I mean, it seems kind of very, very clear that even mega doses of bodily pleasure and mega doses of fame and money and prestige do not, in fact, deliver on this promise of happiness.
In Aristotle, as you well know, happiness isn't a feeling state, and it's a way of life, and it's a life. It's basically a excellent moral life. You know all this, but yet it seems like even good Thomists like yourself, myself, even Father Spitzer, we sort of get, when talking about happiness, we sort of get forced into talking about happiness in relation to feelings, and I'm wondering if we're doing our understanding of happiness real justice when we do that.
I think that's right. I think that's right. The relationship between feelings, or happiness understood as feelings and happiness understood as activity, is something that's actually explored in contemporary psychology as well.
And yeah, I mean, it's in that wonderful book about the experience of rock climbing.
Right.
The professor at the University of Chicago. I mean, it's a brilliant book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so I think you know, this is a real issue where people confuse happiness simply as feelings versus happiness as activity, and actually the most reliable way to generate the positive emotions and feelings is by doing the right sort of activity. That is to say, by doing activity in accordance with virtue, as Aristotle.
What Aquinas would call concomitant effect.
Right. Right, or yes. As the contemporary positive psychologist would say, getting into flow.
Yes, flow is the name of the book I was trying to remember, actually.
Yeah. So
the flow experience.
Exactly. So this is a really interesting place where I find the teaching of ancient philosophers like Aristotle and medieval theologians like Aquinas and contemporary positive psychologists really converge. And sometimes they use different terminology, but I think that their point is you know, quite similar. And so that's kind of what I'm trying to do in the introduction of the book, is to kind of draw on these different resources and suggest that they're really pointing towards similar conclusions.
I've been talking with Professor Christopher Cazor about a book he co-authored with his wife, Jennifer, Seven Big Myths About Marriage, published by Ignatius recently. And it's a wonderful book, and I would recommend, actually, those of you who are considering getting married or just married or groups that are in marriage prep, marriage encounter, take a look at this book. It's really well written, and it is going to be very helpful. Chris Cazor, thanks for being on Church and Culture today.
Oh, thank you, Dio. It's great having a chance to speak with you.
And I hope someday soon you can come back, perhaps with your wife, Jennifer, and we can dig even more deeply. Maybe by then you'll have 8 children to match your 8 books.
Good. Well, thank you.
Okay. You tell her I said that, okay?
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Kazor, and all of you who are listening. Please come back and join me next week on Church and Culture.
If you have any comments or questions about Church and Culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.
As Christians, we are taught that what comes out of the mouth proceeds from the heart. And in Ephesians, it reads, "No bad word should come from your mouth, but only what is good and edifying, that it may give grace to those who hear." If you want to have a clean mouth without having to use soap, start by cleansing the heart. Think back to those various points in life when the anger that festered inside eventually percolated up and right out of your mouth with words of hate for people who have hurt you, offended you, lied to you, used you, abused you, stole from you, or perhaps altered your life forever. When we hold on to the past, we cloud the love of Jesus Christ, and what emerges is the pain inflicted on us from mankind. If you find yourself cursing, spewing hateful words about others, or often negative about life, then close your mouth and open your heart. Fill it with the love of our Lord, and let His words emerge from your mouth. This has been a Christ-centered communication message. I'm Vanessa Denha-Garmo, the communication evangelist.
Are you tired of the way your faith is represented in the mainstream media? Stop getting your Catholic news from secular sources and get it from a trusted local Catholic source instead. At the Michigan Catholic Newspaper, we're Catholic, and we cover your Catholic Church in a way that only Catholics could. For the same reason you listen to Ave Maria, get the Michigan Catholic for just $24 a year by calling 313-224-8000 or visit themichigancatholic.com.
Hi, this is Peter Herbeck, host of Fire on the Earth on Ave Maria Radio and Crossing the Goal on EWTN. Ave Maria Radio is conducting its annual spring membership drive, April 7th through the 11th, and I'm asking you to prayerfully consider pledging your support for this essential voice for the Catholic faith. Tune in April 7th through the 11th and make that pledge to help. Call 877-288-1077 or go online at avemariaradio.net. Thank you and God bless you.
The family is God's first institution. Today, however, with plummeting divorce rates, widespread cohabitation, and the redefinition of marriage, God's institution is in trouble. Join us for a one-day conference April 7th where presenters Jennifer Roback Morse of the National Organization of Marriage and Harry Bereiser from the University of Detroit will share proven techniques that have shown to lower divorce rates and thereby strengthen congregations and communities. Go to dofh.org or call 734-717-1174 to register.
The Ave Maria Communications Guild invites you to activate your faith. Ave Maria radio host Sister Ann Shields will give a Lenten reflection Saturday, April 12th at Immaculate Conception Church in Milan. The reflection is titled Prayer as an Expression of Love. The reflection is free and open to the public, men, women, and youth, confirmation age and up. To reserve your seat, contact the parish office at 734-439-2030. Don't miss the Homeschool Connection Thespian staging of Oscar Wilde's The Ideal Husband, April 10th through the 12th at Whitmore Lake High School. This witty comedy takes you to 18th century London. Family rates are available by pre-order only. To reserve your tickets, call 734-484-3497. You can find many more events and enter your own events at our website, avemariaradio.net. To become a member of the Guild, call 877-288-1077.
The greatest